but it's all over, all over now. You know it's all over town that you threw me down. But you shouldn't let that kind of story go around. 'Cause you had your chance and now it's all over. I'll get along somehow. Now there are things that you did I used to forgive, but you never changed just as long as you live. Oh, I used to love you, but it's all over. Yes, yes, all over now.
Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, bringing you all kinds of amazing truths hidden from public view by the mainstream organs of deception. Today we're going to go straight to a sensitive topic for some listeners, which is the downside of Donald Trump. It seems like there are some people in the truth-seeking community who think that Trump is the be-all, end-all savior, and others, of course, are kind of on the opposite end of that spectrum. I'm sort of in the middle, but there are definitely some problems with Trump. I don't even want to start listing them. Instead, we're going to get right to this new one that just popped up. At least it came to my attention fairly recently, that there's a guy named Kushner who is Trump's son-in-law, and this guy basically wrote Trump's speech at AIPAC for him. It was the most ridiculously kiss-up speech to the Zionists that you've ever heard. It makes the average politician's speech sound positively honest and courageous. And this Kushner character is now, it looks like he's, well, at least his newspaper, is pushing to keep the 28 pages scandal from blowing 9/11 wide open. So this guy looks like a Zionist and a 9/11 cover-up guy, and he is Trump's son-in-law. That doesn't sound good, and my guest Martin Hill brought this to my attention. Martin, is this as bad as it looks?
Well, Kevin, some people think this guy is a great white hope. You know, we talked about my meeting with Trump a few months ago in Michigan when I shouted at him that Israel and the Jews were arrested on 9/11, not Muslims. And, you know, I've always been skeptical, although compared to Hillary and the Jewish communist Bernie Sanders, I don't blame people for wanting Trump, but I'm kind of like,
I'll take the Jewish communist Bernie Sanders any day, but go on.
Oh my gosh. Can you imagine what this country has come to, and this is who people like? It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like Trump has got a certain, you know, he's brought up some issues and crossed some red lines that you have to give him credit for.
I was referring to Sanders.
Sanders.
Okay.
Well, I'll tell you, I actually like Sanders, Martin, because you know, even though I'm a libertarian at heart, and ultimately I would like all redistribution to be done out of the charity in people's hearts at the direction of God, unfortunately, in this current world that we live in, we're in an economy that's piling everything up at the top, and with all the automation, there is simply no more use for wide-scale human labor like there used to be. And we're just going to have to find a new way to spread it around to keep people on a more or less equal playing field. So frankly, I guess, you know, I'm turning into a Jewish socialist myself.
Oh my gosh.
Well, at least a socialist. I haven't, you know, converted to Judaism or anything, but but Sanders, you know, I think there are people who are basically decent and honest in all traditions, and Sanders looks like, yeah, as politicians go, which isn't saying much, he's basically decent and honest. So I basically like the guy.
Okay.
What's wrong? Why am I wrong?
You know, I don't know too much about Sanders, but gosh darn, I mean, even socialism, not a fan of it at all, Kevin. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah,
not interested.
Philosophically, I agree with you. I mean, the government defines itself as the bureaucracy with a plausible monopoly on violence. And so that's not necessarily the group that you want to be in charge of everything and own everybody's property. But when I ran for Congress as a libertarian in 2008, I said deregulate small business. That's where there's still competition. But mm-hmm. with the large organizations, there is no competition. Having them quote-unquote private just means that the rulers of the planet can do any darn thing they want, whereas if they're public with rules of transparency, then they can it can benefit people in general. So I guess I'm a socialist for the big organizations and the rich, and a free marketer for the rest of us, the other 99%.
Well, I heard an interesting conversation with libertarian Tom Woods. He's a friend of Ron Paul, pretty well-known libertarian. And they were having a discussion about the Glass-Steagall Act, which everybody always says, deregulation causes problems, and they're arguing against that. It was an interesting discussion. But the libertarians aren't necessarily a lot of people view them as too friendly with the bankers or too friendly with, basically the system that basically fascist, the people like Mike Rivera always complain about when you don't regulate the big business, they just destroy everybody and everything in their path. So I understand what you're saying. Not everybody in our crowd is a libertarian by any means, So I understand people think if you don't have regulation on the big banks and so forth, then it's a disaster to our economy and to our world. But Tom Woods has written a free ebook on Bernie Sanders. It's called Why Bernie Sanders is Wrong. And he outlines why Sanders' ideas are just would cause horrible pain and suffering to liberty and to individuals,
Well, I'll have to bring him back on the show and talk to him. I've had him as a radio guest, and so I'll.
Oh, yeah, I think that'd be a good topic.
Yeah.
And speaking of libertarians, the reason that I learned this latest bit about this Jared Kushner guy, so he's 35 years old, born in 1981, and he's married to Donald Sun's daughter, Ivanka. She's also 35. And Robert Wenzel over at targetliberty.com, you've had him as a guest before. He also runs Economic Policy Journal. He's a, an Austrian economics guy. And he's very good on the Zionist issue, too. He's criticizes Rand Paul. He was one of the most intelligent and well-versed critics of Rand Paul, which is actually how I came to know this guy several years ago.
Yeah, we talked about that on the show with him. Yeah.
He started writing my articles on Rand Paul. So he wasn't one of these guys who fall for people like Rand Paul, who says, I meet with Jewish groups daily, if you can imagine such a thing. Rand Paul actually said that in a speech. So Robert Wenzel over at Target Liberty, he ran this article yesterday, and the title is, Oh Boy, Trump Rolls Out the Teleprompter. And can I just read a little bit from it?
Yeah, please do.
Bob begins, this will tell us who is getting to Trump. Washington Post reports, quote, there are plans for him, Trump, to soon give a series of policy speeches, perhaps with the assistance of a teleprompter, a device that to him once symbolized the bloodless establishment. And then Bob continues his commentary. We know Trump's son-in-law has influenced Trump on his position on Israel. The Washington Post again, quote, Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has also become a key policy advisor, especially on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Trump credited Kushner with helping to write a speech he gave at a pro-Israel conference last month, APAC, which members of Trump's campaign team have pointed to as a blueprint for future policy speeches that could help shore up the candidate's credibility. So I guess Trump is not credible unless he agrees with this.
Unless he's reading from an Israeli scripted teleprompter, like everybody else.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I'll continue. Kushner, now I'm continuing with the Washington Post here. Kushner, who is married to Trump's daughter, Ivanka, is the owner of the New York Observer, which recently endorsed Trump's presidential bid. Now, I sent you that. People can go to Target Liberty and read Bob's article on Kushner. So that's how I found out about this. I did some research on this Kushner guy. I had heard of him before, as most people probably know, that Trump's son-in-law is Jewish and his daughter Ivanka converted to Judaism. Now, is that irrelevant? It might have been, but not anymore. This Kushner guy is 35-year-old. He was raised, this gets good, Kevin. I mean, my gosh. He went to it's called a yeshiva, Y-E-S-H-I-V-A, yeshiva school. It's a Jewish school specializing in studying historical Jewish texts, particularly, ready for this drum roll?
The Talmud.
The Talmud, that's right. So Jared Kushner is a, I won't call him a Talmud scholar, because supposedly he's not even, couldn't even barely keep his grades up. He's not an academic genius by any means, but he's a Talmud scholar. Went to one of these specialized Talmud schools. And this is who is Donald Trump's new top man. I mean, this is really something else. So I don't think it's irrelevant anymore. If someone was dumb enough to think previously that all this was irrelevant, I don't think it is irrelevant. What do you think?
I don't think so either. And one that you just brushed over, the fact that apparently he got into, which Ivy League school was it? He was way below the cutoff line. There's no way he should have been let within a million miles of that school. But his parents then donated millions of dollars to the school. And so, oh, they made an exception and let this guy in, even though he wasn't even remotely qualified. I think that's emblematic of a certain kind of problem we have, where, you know, we have a new oligarchy or a nobility or, you know, chosen people. I don't know what you want. They're not all Jewish. They're rich people. But then, let's face it, there is a kind of a Jewish ethnic mafia among wealthy, highly educated, you know, elite Jews. And as Kevin McDonald has shown, statistically, they are getting into Ivy League schools. It's actually down now, I guess, to a little bit more reasonable level. For a while, it was way out of proportion in terms of relative qualifications. Less qualified Jews were getting in to the Ivy League schools by quite a major margin. And Kevin McDonald's study leaves no doubt that there's only one plausible explanation for that, which is nepotism. And that this nepotism, where people favor their own group, it's like it's common for a lot of different groups, but it's very, very strong in the Jewish community. Let's face it. That's just, you know, it's not anti-Semitic or prejudiced or racist to face truths like that. It's obvious. And you know, Martin, you've probably read that article by Philip Weiss over at Mondo Weiss. He's a Jewish former New York Times writer. He's been with a lot of big-time major media outfits. Now he's telling the truth on his own blog. And he wrote a piece called Do We Jews Dominate the Media? And So What If We Do? And he talks about the fact that the majority of his bosses and key, you know, major important decision makers in mainstream media throughout his whole career have been his fellow Jews, and they know it, and they prefer to hire their fellow Jews, they prefer to work with their fellow Jews, and this is a problem. And it would be a problem with any ethnic group, and maybe there are some other ethnic groups that operate like that to some extent, I don't know. But I think we should be able to talk about that. And this guy, Kushner, getting into his Ivy League school purely because of the millions of dollars thrown at the administration by his parents is disgusting. And it should be, I mean, whoever's running against Trump should be putting TV commercials all over the place about this. But they won't. You know why? Because they're afraid they're going to be called anti-Semitic. I'm so sick of that word, that utterly meaningless term.
Right. And speaking of Philip Weiss, ironically, he used to write for the New York Observer, which Kushner owns. I'm not sure if he wrote for them while Kushner owned it. He bought it in 2006. So that would be interesting to find out if he wrote during that time. But as far as I was going to get to the Harvard part, so I'll just quote this from the Wikipedia page on Kushner. So he was raised in a Jewish family in New Jersey. He graduated, like I said, from the yeshiva school and from Harvard College in 2003 with a degree in sociology. And according to journalist Daniel Golden, Kushner and his brother Joshua were admitted to Harvard despite modest academic credentials after their father, Charles Kushner, had made a $2.5 million donation to the university. Now listen to this. This is interesting. The director of Harvard's college prep program described George Kushner's admission as, quote, an unusual choice for Harvard to make, given that he was not anywhere near the top of his class. So, but anyway,
I thought Harvard didn't usually select from the bottom of the class, but I guess they had to make an exception.
Well, for $2.5 million for two brats, of course. So after Harvard, he went to law school. Kushner worked for the Manhattan District Attorney. Now, there's something very interesting, Kevin. His father, who's a real estate magnate, Charles Kushner, okay, hold on one second. He was sentenced. Now, you know Chris Christie just endorsed Trump, right?
I hadn't heard that, but I believe it.
You know, Governor Chris Christie, and you didn't hear that?
Did he just do that now? I know
No, it was about a few months ago. But,
oh, okay, yeah. I heard that then, yeah, okay.
this is related because Jared Kushner's father, Charles, he was arrested and convicted on charges of tax evasion, illegal campaign donations, and witness tampering, Kevin, in 2004. And he was convicted of the charges. And he spent 2 years in prison. Do you know who put him in prison? Chris Christie, who was a federal prosecutor, put in prison. This is interesting because Christie endorses Trump. And Christie made a deal, gave this Charles Kushner 2 years in federal prison. And that's the father of Trump's son-in-law. That's very interesting and funny.
All in the
amazing
family, huh? Small world.
And then this gets even better. Charles Kushner, who's 61, and he's a successful, supposedly, real estate developer in New York.
And criminal.
Yeah, he's a criminal. We could actually call him a criminal because he is one. His parents were a, drum roll again, guess what his parents were, Kevin?
Oh, pioneers of Zionism.
And better than that. Okay. Holocaust survivors.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, so here we go. It's come full circle. So the Kushners, Holocaust survivors. There you go. What else can you say about that?
So are there any details on that? Like, because you know, some people say basically any Jewish person who's alive after World War II is a Holocaust survivor. You know, and then there are people who have a more strict definition that, like, you actually had to be in a concentration camp or whatever. Do you have any details?
I said they fled Poland in the 1940s via Italy, and that's all.
So there were rich people who got out. Okay, so that's a survivor.
Yeah. Now, let's switch to the Observer real quick, the New York Observer. When I was doing research on this Jared Kushner, so he bought this. It's a weekly newspaper out in New York. He's converted it in the last 10 years to kind of a tabloid format. Now, I want to cover two articles that I mentioned to you that are in the Observer. Hold on 1 second here. This is really rich. The first one, I'll just give you two headlines that are on the front page of Observer.com today. Now, remember, this is Donald Trump's key advisor, his son-in-law, the Jewish Talmud expert, all right? The first one says Putin wants to ignite World War III. So they're demonizing Putin. You know, the neocon line. There you go. So these people who think Trump is somehow going to rise above all this and going to save everybody, that's like I told you a few months ago when I was talking to you. It's absurd. Yeah, Trump, I did like his response to me when I said that Jews were arrested on 9/11. Israel did 9/11. Trump replies by saying, I'm a Trump guy and I'm on his side. And
good thing Kushner wasn't there on stage with Trump, or he would have probably called out the thugs on you.
Yeah, I think so. I wonder if he was there. That would be very interesting. I got to see this guy's picture because, yeah, that would be interesting, right? But at any rate, the first headline is, here's how the article starts against Putin. So this is Donald Trump's son-in-law writing. He's not writing the article, but this is his newspaper, so he obviously approves this line. By letting Putin get away with whatever he likes in Syria, Obama has created a deeply dangerous situation. By letting Putin get away with whatever he likes, as if Putin is some boogeyman who's doing... Putin is killing the government-funded terrorists who are killing Christians, according to all the Catholic archbishops in Syria. They say Putin's a hero, first of all. So Putin was invited into Syria. We were not, as you well know. So that's the first piece of disgusting propaganda run by Jared Kushner on his newspaper today. Now, the main one I want to get to on Observer.com by Jared Kushner's newspaper, it's written by a guy named John Schindler. Schindler's List, maybe? John Schindler identifies himself as a counterintelligence officer formerly working for the NSA, all right? Now, John Schindler has this article, and it's titled Uncovering the Hidden Truths of 9/11. Now, I sent this to you earlier. You probably read it, correct?
I did. Yeah, that was pretty interesting. It's a talk about a bait-and-switch headline, Uncovering the Hidden Truths of 9/11, Why We Need to Discuss More Than Just Saudi Arabia. That sounds like a headline for one of my pieces over at Veterans Today or Press TV. But you actually read it, and it is a total piece of disinformation. It's not even a limited hangout. It's disinformation, pure and simple.
Now, let me read. Can I read a quick piece of this article, this propaganda article written
sure,
by,
go ahead.
In running a Donald Trump's son-in-law's newspaper? Schindler begins. Regrettably, the 9/11 Commission, which was established to get to the bottom of that national tragedy, dodged certain key questions. Though, in fairness, its members, the commission was not allowed to see some important evidence. Here's the best part right here, folks. For want of a complete explanation, conspiracy theories have proliferated about 9/11, promising the, quote, real story. Most of this is toxic silliness with bizarre internet theorizing by fools and charlatans about how the Twin Towers were, quote, really destroyed by persons not in Al-Qaeda. Jews, the Pentagon, the Illuminati, or space aliens, depending on your preferred flight of fancy. Such ridiculousness, I'm almost done, such ridiculousness unfortunately obscures the reality that there remain important unanswered questions about the plane's operation. Let me state that the job done by the 9/11 Commission was essentially accurate but incomplete. The attacks were the work of Al-Qaeda, and their airborne assaults on the towers and the Pentagon unfolded just as the U.S. government has told you. So that's Donald Trump's son-in-law's newspaper saying this, that you and I, Kevin, are fools and charlatans and toxic silliness and bizarre internet theorizing, and we think space aliens did it and all this stuff. So there you go.
Yeah, it's total low-grade propaganda, and it just shows the contempt that they hold for their own readers. Yep. But, you know, what can you say? That's pretty much the rule these days.
Yeah, so I don't know. Do you think Trump's going to win?
Yeah, mathematically, I think I've seen some arguments that he has a pretty good chance. And I've also heard from skeptics, or some would say cynics, like Joel Hirshhorn. I had him on recently. And he thinks that they're going to find a way to steal it from Trump. He said it was only a 20% chance that either Trump or Sanders would win their party's nominations, despite being the only candidates that any ordinary people actually like. So, you know, we'll see how that plays out. But no, I think he probably will, because I think he's a sharp enough operator who's in a position now where he has a shot at being president. And I don't think he's probably going to blow it by continuing to act like he has any integrity at all, or, you know, he's going to blurt out truths that he shouldn't blurt out. I think he'll probably be a kind of a new Donald Trump. And we'll see him moderating a lot of his positions and his style, maybe reading off a Zionist teleprompter like all the other candidates, you know, and they'll probably win.
Yeah. Well, there's a big transformation. Matter of fact, his campaign manager, who was, turned out not to be charged with assault from that attention-seeking reporter. Apparently, they're getting rid of a lot of those people and putting in more establishment Zionist types. They're surrounded by Kushner, and so yeah, Trump reading off a teleprompter—that's very interesting. So it should be interesting campaign season to watch this circus. That's for sure.
Yeah, I actually at this point I would bet on Trump rather than Hillary. You know, the conventional wisdom is that Trump is a setup to scare the bejesus out of enough people that they'll elect Hillary. That, you know, Hillary is the, you know, the choice of the Illuminati or the CFR, whoever they are. You know, she's been anointed. So that's the conventional wisdom. But I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure if I fully believe in that total anointing thing. And I'm not sure the powers that be necessarily feel like they're so terrified of Trump that they would, you know, really do anything to stop him. I mean, I'm not sure he's really that dangerous. So as I see it politically, Hillary has really intense negatives, and there's no way she's ever going to fix them. There's just nothing she can do to get those negatives down among the independent voters and, you know, the key people. And she has, you know, there's no enthusiasm for her whatsoever. You know, none, except for maybe, you know, three or four soccer moms somewhere who say, a woman president, you know, we don't care what woman, just put a female in the Oval Office. So there's, on the other side with Trump, there's still going to be some enthusiasm, I think, even if he does moderate his style. And then he's pretty good at negative campaigning and, you know, getting personal. And Hillary is just a sitting duck for that. So I really think if it's Trump versus Hillary, you know, the conventional wisdom that that's a setup so that Hillary can waltz into the White House, I think that's wrong. I think it'll be Trump waltzing into the White House over the bloody little bits and pieces of Hillary.
Yeah, well, I certainly would. If I had to choose, I certainly would choose Trump over Hillary. That's the last person who should ever be anywhere near the White House. But it should be interesting. I don't even vote, Kevin, to be honest with you. So I'm just watching all this. it should be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, we still have these front row seats of the apocalypse. I'll tell you, it's an interesting world. We're cursed to live in interesting times.
Yeah, I don't think that I don't know if they would allow Trump because he's, despite his defects, he's not completely controlled like Clinton and the other establishment candidates. So I do think he actually is a rogue candidate. I do believe that, you know.
He's been a rogue candidate in certain respects, and then you know we'll find out just how rogue he could end up being if he actually got to be president. Maybe I hope I'm wrong. I mean, I would love to see Trump become president, and then you know say, hey, you know, we're going to really shake things up here. You know, we're going to pull out of all NAFTA, CAFTA, GATT. We're going to tear up the TPP. We're going to rebuild our industry here. We're going to pull back from these foreign military bases and stop doing these foreign wars. And we're going to make these people pay for our imperial presence in their countries. And if they won't pay, we're coming home. And of course, that means we're coming home. All of those things would be great. I mean, I hope that happens, but I'm not going to hold my breath.
Yeah, we're pretty much on the same page, although it should be interesting. I'm going to keep an eye on this Kushner guy at libertyfight.com within the next few days. I'm going to release an article pretty much outlining what we've talked about on this Kushner character. So I just found out about it yesterday. So it should be interesting to watch. I hope he is not too influenced. Trump is getting up there. He's going to be 70. So I actually know when people get to be a certain age, they are influenceable, you know. And I hope this guy, this clown, this Talmud expert, I won't say expert, I'll say a Talmud follower. Let's put it that way. I think that's more accurate, you know.
He sounds almost like a Talmud dropout.
Yeah, but he will definitely point Trump in a certain direction. We know that. It's bad. It's bad news.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, before I let you go, we're almost at the end of the half hour. I want to hear your thoughts on this 28 pages scandal, the bill in Congress that would allow 9/11 victims' families to sue foreign governments for 9/11. It's aimed at Saudi Arabia, but you might have one or two people who might decide to sue a different certain foreign government. And this is all over the mainstream now. 60 Minutes covered it. Could these 28 pages actually blow 9/11 up? Because, I mean, if the Saudis start taking the fall, well, there's Bush smoking a cigar and celebrating 9/11 with Bandar, like the day after it happened, smoking a cigar with Bandar on the White House balcony. I mean, how could they blame the Saudis without also blaming the Bush family and then the neocons and then the Israelis?
I tend to agree with Brandon Martinez and Dr. Henry McCow, who say this is just a smokescreen to divert attention away from the real culprits, the government who we know was involved in 9/11. And it wasn't, it might have been the Saudis in some certain way, but we know the Israelis were totally involved. So why don't they investigate the Israelis and continue that investigation that they never completed? There were hundreds of Israelis arrested across the United States on and after 9/11. What happened to that story?
Absolutely. And the Saudi patsies were really set up so that Saudi Arabia could be blamed, and so Muslims could be blamed. And it was the Israelis that did the setting up through their control of those elements of the CIA that brought those 15 guys over here on snitch visas. I mean, those 15 Saudis were CIA agents. And if that comes out, that's going to be pretty interesting. I mean, that's not officially confirmed information in public, but I have it from two sources. Well, one of them, the brother-in-law of somebody I know, his brother-in-law being in the CIA, who said this. And then I have another CIA source as well. I have two CIA sources confirming that those 15 Saudis were here in the United States on CIA snitch visas. So I'm hoping it's all going to blow up. But like you, Martin, I wouldn't be all surprised if it gets spun into some kind of limited hangout.
Right. Yeah, exactly. That's why I'm not too excited about it. I think it's absurd.
Well, I'm excited because, I mean, any chance, like, you know, give me something that holds out a 2% chance to blow 9/11 up. I'll start jumping up and down. Give me something with it's a 5 or 10% chance. And I think this is pushing up towards 5 or 10%. That gets me real excited. So, you know, maybe I'm just easily excitable.
Well, you know what, Kevin? Actually, this would be in the public sphere, the general public. It would be a great opportunity for people like you to bring up the topic and then, you know, start talking about
it. Tell me about it. I'm doing it every day on Press TV.
Yeah. Yep. That's right.
Okay, well, hey, thanks, Martin Hill. I appreciate your great work. It's libertyfight.com, and this is great information about Trump's son-in-law. I wonder how the Trump supporters in my audience are going to respond. I guess we'll find out. So anyway, thanks so much for another great interview. Keep up the great work.
Thanks, Kevin. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye. See ya. Bye. Welcome back to Truth Jihad Radio. This is Kevin Barrett bringing you all of the interesting news about false flags, political assassinations, mind control, media propaganda, and all these other topics that are really locked out of the mainstream. Let's not forget Zionism. I never want to forget that. So today we're going to get back to my old favorite topic, which is literature. I spent a lot of my life studying literature. I actually have 4 advanced degrees in various literatures. So politics really is not my thing. Literature is. And I can say that there is some overlap between 9/11 activism and literature. There are a lot of novels and literary efforts coming out of 9/11. And believe it or not, some of them are actually quite good. And I'm going to be talking with one of my favorite 9/11 authors. Let me start by saying that of all of this, I have a pretty big 9/11 lit shelf. And I would say that the 4 really, really serious literary things that have been done with 9/11 that I know about so far are, let me go ahead and name them, not necessarily in order. There's Tom Braidenbach's The Wicked Child, a collection of poems. The other side of his book is 9/11 in Roman numerals. That is sheer genius. There's Victoria Alexander's Locus Amanus, which is quite brilliant as well, and actually has Tom and me as characters, or versions thereof. And there's Thomas Pynchon's Bleeding Edge, okay? Those are like 3 really serious literary approaches to 9/11. Now, we have a couple of good novels that don't quite get into 9/11 truth, but sort of brush around the edges. There's The Unknown Terrorist by an Australian novelist, Richard Flanagan, which is quite brilliant and just rips the war on terror apart and exposes a false flag. We have Mohsin Hamid's The Reluctant Fundamentalist, which is from an Islamic perspective, quite good. And finally, the last but far from least in terms of remarkable, really good, sophisticated literary efforts around 9/11. We have Days of Shock, Days of Wonder, The 9/11 Age, The Ways of the Mystics, and One Man's Escape from Babylon in the Belly of a Whale by Rafik. And I've got a couple of dozen of these types of books, and I just told you the ones that are really good. And Rafik is here, gracing the show. So, hey, welcome, Rafik, and congratulations on doing really good 9/11 Lit.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks so much for that.
Yeah, it's good to have you back on the show. This is important. I mean, the culture is really where our values and our awareness come out of, and you know, the 19th century literature kind of replaced religion as the West's highbrow religion. People stopped picking apart the Bible and started, you know, going back over the literary traditions of nations. So this is really important stuff. You're not just a dilettante. You know, you're working in a very important area.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I have a degree in literature. You have various degrees in literature. and so I'm a writer first. I think I started to identify myself as a writer at about the age of 7. And I never expected to write necessarily about 9/11. But one of my role models is Nina Simone, the singer and activist. And one of the things she says is that it's the duty of the artist to reflect their times. And so in alignment with that, I eventually ended up bending my literary abilities, you know, to this task of writing a memoir that could encapsulate the times that we're living in, you know, politically and also spiritually. This is where I part ways with Simone a little bit. Well, in terms of that quote, probably not in terms of what she achieved and what she produced, but I'm also interested in the timeless, the spiritual that transcends the particulars of the age we're living in. And like all the great activists that I admire, you know, from Gandhi to King, Desmond Tutu, they all bring their spirituality into their political, you know, their political agenda and their actions. So that's what my journey was about. And in order to, you know, to be an activist and to be a writer, I had to bring all those things together into this particular book.
Indeed. It's such a great read. For me, it struck home in so many different ways. And of course, I sort of, you know, lived a different trajectory in that it was actually at almost exactly the same moment I discovered 9/11 Truth that I finally moved to a permanent home after having been a nomad for all my life. Whereas in your book, 9/11 makes you kind of turns you into a nomad. But I can relate because I used to be a nomad. I used to live in a vehicle, as you do, as in the book, kind of a, you know, Kerouac style on the road existence. And you know, 9/11 certainly did change my life and put me on a certain kind of a road. So I could really relate to this in a lot of ways, and it was such a fun, lively read. It's the kind of literature that the people I used to hang out in San Francisco really like. You know, it's not pretentious at all. It's very, very honest, nakedly honest autobiography of somebody who's kind of living outside of social conventions.
Yeah, and one thing that I'm really pleased with is that it's finding an audience with mainstream readers, with people who aren't necessarily already acquainted with the paradigm that we're living under, you know, in the post 9/11 false flag age, and they haven't fled from it, they haven't rejected it, and I think a lot of the 9/11 activism that we end up doing is preaching to the choir and talking to people who are already on the same page. So, again, by using literature, you know, all art can break down these walls between people. And I've had people tell me, even after reading the book, that they don't necessarily feel like I forced them at that moment in time to decide for themselves whether or not 9/11 was a false flag. But I simply presented it in a way that helped them understand why I thought it was a false flag and why it redirected the course of my life. And what I recognize in that is that at the very least a seed has been planted. They may down the road decide that they want to come to that realization for themselves, but they've finished reading the book and they haven't rejected it. There's a coffee shop here in Sayulita, Mexico, where I live, that is selling the book, and one of the tourists in town, so not somebody I already knew, but somebody passing through town, bought a copy of the book and then recognized me on the beach from the author photo. And then ran into me a few days later and said, you know, your book's taking me out of my comfort zone. And I said, well, you know, it was hard to live. It might be hard to read. He said, no, it's okay. It's not hard to read. I'm just telling you what's happening. So that was something. That was really interesting to hear.
Well, you're a good ambassador for the truth movement in that, as you say, people who are not really on board can really engage with your persona in the book, I think, and it's probably better that way. You know, that was one of the criticisms I got with Truth Jihad from Publishers Weekly in their review. They basically praised me to the skies as like a modern Rabelais, and they kept compared me to H.L. Mencken, and you know, wow, I was like, that's pretty cool. But then at the end, but finally at the end of the day, you know, this guy's a conspiracy theorist, and if you're not on board with his 9/11 stuff, you probably won't want to read this. Okay, I think that some people react to truthers in the way that some people react to Jehovah's Witnesses. Oh no, not them at the door! They're going to talk my ear off. They'll never shut up. They won't stop until I convert to their point of view. And your book does not come on that strong at all. It's very easy. I can imagine that people who are not on board yet could read it and relate to you and be taken out of their comfort zone, which is, I guess, what we want.
Yeah, because this paradigm we're living under is, you know, I imagine now if I had experienced 9/11, you know, knowing what I know today, how different my entire experience would have been. That book wouldn't exist, right, the way that it exists.
Yes, and, indeed.
And, you know, so what is that paradigm? And I know that you've written about it in two of your books, most recently Another French False Flag. And I'd like to talk about that today, that new paradigm that we're living under, and how, it should start to become apparent to people that we're not living in the same world, maybe they haven't put their finger on it yet exactly what's different enough that they can recognize it. You know, one of my great uncles was a semi-professional magician, a very, very good magician. And he taught me a lot of stuff, and I used to do magic shows at birthday parties. I hired myself out when I was, you know, 13 or something like that. But one of the things that a magician is always told is that you never show your trick to the same audience twice. And what a false flag operation is essentially a trick. And we've been shown this trick again and again and again and again now, to the point where you come out at the front of, you know, another French false flag and basically say, you know, we have to operate from the assumption now that these are false flags first, you know, rather than giving the benefit of the doubt to the authorities. And I agree with you entirely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that it is a bit of a paradigm shift since 9/11. I don't think most people even heard of the term false flag after 9/11. And now, with each of these big false flags, and most recently Brussels, my first reaction pieces, questioning them and assuming that they're a false flag, are all getting either close to or way over into the six figures worth of reads almost instantly as soon as I put them up. That's a lot of people who are looking for information about possible false flags. And there's a spiritual dimension to this that you get into in your book too, I think, which, the people who retreat from the world into spirituality and try to avoid politics, and we see a lot of people like that just, you know, don't want to be bothered with the world of politics, often assuming it's all corrupt. But I think the more authentic spiritual path, as far as I'm concerned anyway, is one of engagement with the politics. And this is not something new. I mean, this has been going on for a long time. I'm reading Dante's Divine Comedy with my son, sort of some post-secondary homeschooling. And we noticed Dante was exiled from Florence, and there's all the politics around that gets tied into his metaphysics. And it made us think that, you know, literature used to be very spiritually, religiously engaged. And in recent times, it's been reconstructed as a nationalistic sort of thing and a kind of a substitute for religion that actually is very, overall, very, very strongly secular and naturalistic and so on. But you've brought spirituality and, you know, some would say religion, although others would question that word, into this book. As part of the political domain post 9/11.
Yeah, and I think 9/11 was an event that invited that, obviously, because the Patsies were supposedly, you know, religious fundamentalists. And, you know, one of my first reactions was to try to understand the psychology of these supposed, suicide hijackers who had flown these planes into these towers. And I was really preoccupied with trying to understand that for quite a while, and to understand, you know, that aspect of fundamentalism, or which is actually a misnomer. There's nothing fundamental to the religion about that behavior. It's you know, probably better identified as extremism. But so 9/11 then required me to look at these, not only the political lies eventually, but first at the religious context and the religious lies. I write in the memoir about traveling to Indonesia and working at an Islamic university there. I was an editor in residence, as it were, working with the graduate students, and being surrounded by colleagues who were living and practicing Islam. And one of the events I write about is someone from the Islamic Embassy, or rather the U.S. Embassy, coming to the campus looking for Islamic extremists, you know, for terrorists, essentially, and questioning my colleagues about where the breeding grounds were on campus for these types of extremists.
And tell them to go down and check out the student union.
Well, my colleague told him, he said, "Sir, this is an Islamic university." "Yes." "Well, that means that we study Islam." "Yes." "Well, that means that we understand that Islam doesn't teach murder and mayhem and all these things that you think that you're going to find here." He said, if you're going to find extremism among, you know, Muslim students. You might find it at the public universities where they don't study Islam. And you know, and then he showed him a list of madrasas, high schools, where he thought that they might have been hotbeds for extremism. And again, the U.S. Embassy had absolutely no idea what they were talking about. So,
of course,
you know, that's something I did want to portray in the book, was a narrative that counters propaganda around Islam. But you know, it's kind of, Kevin, it's frustrating. I'm a book editor for scholars. I've worked with many Islamic scholars editing their books in the 15 years, you know, since 1999 I started, so 17 years now. And I've often said to them, do you want to qualify what you're saying about 9/11? Do you want to put the word alleged in front of hijacker? Do you want to acknowledge any of the other literature, like scholars do, that contradicts, you know, you towing the line with the official story? No, they don't. I had one scholar say to me, Bin Laden admitted he did it, and that's enough for me.
Wow.
Well, pathetic. We all know Bin Laden confession video is a fabrication, and well documented as such.
Right, so, right. Yeah, that lack of curiosity, especially among Muslims, is very strange to me. I was just interviewing somebody from the Nation of Islam, who was, you know, we were sort of wondering, you know, why so few mainstream Muslims have spoken out bravely about this, even though the polls show the majority do get it. Well, you know, if somebody was looking for the radical fundamentalist terrorists in the mosques in Miami in 2001, the guy in the mosque would say, well, no, you should go over to the bar or the strip club, or maybe you should go to Jack Abramoff's casino boats or Las Vegas, because that's where Mohammed Atta and his friends hang out. They've never been to a mosque in their lives.
Right. And in your book, I think it was Paul Craig Roberts cited 150 occasions when the FBI has successfully deceived people into participating in these terror plots. Mm-hmm. So where's the FBI finding these people? They have to fabricate them. They have to groom them.
Yeah, they're pros at that.
That's part of this false flag paradigm that we're talking about.
Right, right. And at some point, theoretically, the paradigm shift should reach critical mass, and these false flags should really start backfiring in a big way. So far, we've really only had a couple that have majorly backfired. One was the Madrid bombing, and of course that was because the government couldn't get its story straight, and the people were very, very skeptical. They were very, very opposed to the Iraq war, and the government in Madrid was cheering for the Iraq war. And so that bombing right before the elections was supposed to give the right-wing government a mandate to go into Iraq all out, but it didn't work that way, and the voters threw them out. That was the best false flag fail of all time, I think. And then there was the Al-Ruta chemical weapons attack in Syria a couple of years ago that was also a pretty big fail. There should be more of those, though. You know, you would really think that whatever the agendas of the perpetrators are, they should be not getting it. It should be backfiring. People should be not going along with it. But still, it seems more often than not, they do accept the official story more or less. You know, you don't get a major pushback against it the way we did in Al-Ruta and after Madrid.
Yeah, I think the problem, Kevin, is, you know, I remember when I was in university in the early 90s, and Noam Chomsky's documentary Manufacturing Consent was on tour across the country, and I saw it on, you know, on the campus I was at. And there was a real conscious effort at that time to educate us about the effect that media had on us and the way that media was constructing our reality. And, you know, when I was in high school, for example, there were no media studies courses, and there were in the decade following. And so there was a whole shift that happened around our awareness of what media is and how it works. I know it goes all the way back to Marshall McLuhan, but we were really becoming conscious of it and bringing it into the classroom. Well, what there needs to be is the equivalent of that around the concept of what a PSYOP, a psychological operation, is. We really need to bring that into the mainstream and educate our populace about what a psychological operation looks like, because it has the same components every time it's run. It's the magic trick I was referring to again and again and again. So if we just tell people what the components are, then maybe they'll start to recognize it. You know, you talked about the Madrid being a failure, and that's because I would argue that's because it occurred in Europe, in a country that had experienced brutal fascism during the Second World War. I think Europeans are more aware of the distinction, although they didn't show it after the Paris attacks, but the distinction between a true terrorist assassin, and a fascist assassin. A terrorist will attack a political target in order to change the status quo, in order to redirect, you know, the course of events. Whereas the fascist assassin or agitator will attack innocent civilians in order to maintain the status quo. And Hitler was a genius at this, with the brown shirts going into Berlin and just walking indiscriminately into pubs where they knew their opponents gathered, political opponents, but just innocent civilians out for an evening on the town, and they would gun them down in cold blood. Well, that's essentially what these mercenaries are doing at the cafes in Paris, the Paris attack, or in any of these, the Bernardino shooting and so on. These are the brown shirts. These are the Nazi tactics. These are the fascists murdering innocent civilians in order to maintain the status quo, which is essentially the government's agenda of increased, where do you start? Increased war, increased fascism, increased surveillance of its citizenry, and on and on. This isn't terrorism. This isn't true terrorism. So let's make that distinction. Let's start to educate ourselves about these things within psychological operations. Are you there, Kev?
Yeah, sorry. I like the distinction you're making between terrorist violence and fascist violence. I think that the word terrorist, of course, is contested, and you know, there are kind of two senses. One sense is the sense you're using, which is somebody opposed to the government or status quo using violence, and that's, of course, really
revolutionary.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. The textbook definition of terrorism is intentional attacks on civilians to create fear for political purposes. But of course, under that definition, governments are virtually the only terrorists that matter, because 99.9% of all of the civilians killed for political purposes in attacks designed to instill fear are killed by governments. So there's a kind of a weird, you know, Orwellian kind of dichotomy between the real definition of terrorism, which under which governments are virtually the only terrorists that exist, and then this bogus kind of unspoken, vague way that the word terrorism is used in the media and in the establishment to connote basically any kind of anti-establishment, any anti-government violence.
Yeah, including 9/11 truth activists.
Right, yeah, they're redefining truthers as terrorists. We've had some at least tentative efforts there.
Yeah. Making this distinction, though, I should make clear that I'm not advocating the revolutionary kind of violence either to change the status quo. On a spiritual front, part of remaining in the world and doing this political work is to have made a very clear choice about not becoming the enemy that I'm confronting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that, although I think that it's really, I don't think that there are any absolute cut and dry distinctions. At some level, most people will use violence to defend themselves and their loved ones if they're directly under attack at that moment. And then maybe, and there are other situations where violence and self-defense is appropriate. And in Islam, of course, somewhat more strongly than in most kinds of Christianity, it's assumed that the best way of organizing society is to have the good people be the leaders. and of course, those are the people who probably don't particularly want to be the leaders, but that's the kind of leadership you need. And what that means is that, you know, theoretically at least, rather than allowing force and violence to be the domain of the psychopathic greedheads, instead the good people have to undertake the unpleasant duty of organizing force in such a way as to make sure that good rules on earth.
Right. An interesting case was when Vaclav Havel, the poet and playwright, was put into power following the revolution in Czechoslovakia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So they got their hands dirty. They did all the violent work of the revolution, and then they brought in the peaceful poet playwright to lead the country. Mm-hmm. Interesting balance they were able to strike.
Right. And it's interesting that, you know, Muslims always seem to be portrayed under the aura of violence, whereas other kinds of activists who use violence aren't. Like Nelson Mandela's ANC was quite violent. That was a revolutionary organization that blew things up and killed in self-defense, and sometimes maybe not even such clear-cut self-defense. And yet he's kind of seen as a modern Gandhi, whereas, say, Hamas or various other resistance groups from the Islamic side, Islamic Jihad and so on, are always going to be just automatically portrayed in the media as terrorists.
No, I'm glad you bring that up, that example of Mandela. You know, from the portrayals I've seen, it looked like they originally started out to damage infrastructure, sort of like the Weather Underground did in the United States, and right. How Anonymous does today with their hacks. They don't want to harm people, but to harm the pocketbook. It's like the natives say up in Canada, the only way that they'll listen to us is if we hit them in their pocketbook. That's why we block the railways, and then their shipments can't run from the ports in Montreal inland to Toronto and the prairies. So that's how Mandela started out. But then you get into that gray area, and it happened with the Weather Underground, where people end up getting accidentally killed or eventually killed because you've compromised. You've compromised. Now, defending themselves is a different thing, and getting into those situations. But let's keep it on the level that most of us can relate to. Most of us aren't armed, and most of us aren't in activist groups that are interested in acquiring weapons. What I've seen happen from Seattle on all the way through the G20 in Toronto is we get these nonviolent protesters who show up at these events by the thousands. They get pepper sprayed, rubber bullets shot at them, water cannons, blasting at them. They get put in cages. In the G20 summit, they got put in cages in the hot sun for several hours in the street. And then there were lawsuits and all kinds of complaints. We showed up to be peaceful, and they attacked us with their weapons. Well, honestly, I think I applaud their desire to be there and to be nonviolent, but if you have a real revolution, if you're really serious about having a nonviolent revolution and standing up to this kind of violence in these protest situations, then you do what we've seen happen in so many countries, particularly the Latin American countries. When there's a revolution, that revolution infiltrates every level of society. So in the case of the G20 summits, you would have had janitorial staff, secretaries, garage mechanics in all of the police stations throughout Toronto, filling the ignitions with crazy glue and poking holes in the gas tanks of all of those police cars the night before the G20. You would have had somebody hiding all the ammunition for all of the weapons and all the bullets. You would have had a real planned, nonviolent way of staging a revolution against this violence within your culture. And, Gandhi was a strategist. He was, he didn't just blindly show up at places and get beaten unless he knew he was going to, and he told his people, this is what's going to happen. You're going to show up, they're going to club you, we're going to take you away and bandage you. But unless you go in there knowing that, you better have strategies. So I'm all for nonviolence, but I don't think we've really gotten very creative with it from what I've seen.
That all sounds great to me. Well, Rafiq, I'm sorry, we're at the end of the half hour, and I wish we needed an hour show right now, because I'd like to continue, but unfortunately, we only need a half hour, so we'll have to bring you back before too long. But where can people go to find out more about your book?
The easiest is just to search for it at Amazon, and they'll find reviews there and other links.
Days of Shock, Days of Wonder. The 9/11 Age, The Ways of the Mystics, and One Man's Escape from Babylon in the Belly of a Whale. Even a few keywords from that might very well bring it up. Well, thank you so much, Rafiq. It's been great, and I look forward to another one before too long.
Thank you, Kevin. Always a pleasure.
All right. Take care.
But it's all over. Yes, yes. All over now. Thank you. long as you live. Oh, I used to love you, but it's all over. All over. Get thee behind me, Satan.